Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Trey Orndorff, a political scientist at Oklahoma Christian University, and I'm joined by the professor of law at Chase Law School, Ken Katkin. But I am also specially joined by Liz Katkin, who is a lawyer, an author, a fertility expert, and a consultant. In her day job, she is a corporate lawyer serving general counsel for LDK Logistics Incorporated. And in her spare time, she is a nonprofit board member and a self-proclaimed political junkie. Ken, Liz, I'd like to welcome you both to the show.
Thanks, Trey.
Yeah, thanks, Trey. I'm happy to be here.
I'm going to be honest, I feel a little bit outgunned today. You know, I got the illustrious Katkin brother and sister here, and I know you guys you're going to outflank me on the left probably. So I feel like I got to dig in today and tap my inner J and be extra conservative.
Yeah, well, you can, or you can prey on Liz's inexperience at this thing.
Liz, do you have any response to him on that front?
Oh, it's been the weaker Katkin, so I've had a lifetime of getting used to it.
This is going to be a lot of fun. So, Liz, thank you so much for joining us today on The Politics Guys and being here. And, Ken, I would thank you, but you're always here. You have to be here. It's a requirement.
I took my vows.
Exactly. Well, we've got a lot of really good stories, I think, for us this show. We're going to be starting out talking about Trump and his racketeering charges in Georgia, the fallout from that. We'll also be talking a little bit about what we see coming forward in terms of the first of the primary debates as they might go forward next week or might not go forward. We're going to take a look at what a little story that became a big, fascinating story of a police raid of a Kansas City paper. We're also going to talk about some standoffs we've seen in the Senate over normal rules as it comes to confirming military leaders. And then we have a few other things on deck, depending on what we have in course of time. So what we're going to start with, though, is we're going to start with what undoubtedly is the biggest story of the week. And that is the Trump racketeering charges. So it feels like the last few weeks of The Politics Guys has really been the look at who today has been charged, and prominent among who has been charged over the last few weeks, of course, is former President Donald Trump getting yet another charge along with a number of co-conspirators in a case coming out of Georgia. Now, the case where a grand jury has brought an indictment after a two-year investigation by Fulton County District Attorney Danny Willis. The charges surround Trump's effort to undo his 2020 defeat in Georgia. Now, it appears that Trump is going to turn himself in Georgia sometime next week. At least as of Friday, it appears that he's looking to do that in approximately a week. We'll see what comes of that. Now, the initial probe came from a recorded phone call on January 2nd in 2021, in which then-President Trump urged Republican Brad Raffensperger to find enough votes to overturn the election. Now, as a reminder, there has and was both a recount and a partial forensic audit of it, and no issues were uncovered. But nevertheless, that's where Trump lays some of that blame, we might put in quotation marks. Now, in that final tally, of course, Trump loses by about 12,000 votes out of the 5 million votes cast in Georgia. As a result of that two-year probe, this week, Willis recommended that the trial begin in March of 2024 on approximately March 4th, or that's right before Super Tuesday, and I think something that we'll all need to talk about. Now, although there hasn't been any motion from Trump's attorneys yet, because, of course, he hasn't turned himself in, Trump's attorneys in other cases have argued that for his other criminal trials, yeah, that's unfortunate when you have to be saying that sentence, that the trial should be held after November 2024, that is, after the presidential election. Now, meanwhile, one of the co-conspirators who has also been charged, Mark Meadows, the former chief of staff, and, of course, one of those co-defendants that I've just mentioned, has launched an attempt to move the charges to federal court from state court, according to the Wall Street Journal. Now, this notice of removal, what that means effectively is that you're trying to change the venue to federal court, is going to be heard here on August 28th. Now, it appears from a number of legal scholars there's a possibility of that moving forward. But whether it moves forward or not, even if it's eventually not allowed, it would allow for a significant amount of delay because that would allow you to have a number of appeals. So that's a lot right there. So I'm just going to pause right here. And Liz, since you're our guest, I'm going to let you have kind of the first crack. What do you think about kind of these, I would say, historic number of charges, but specifically the Georgia charges coming against Trump from Danny Willis?
Well, I think it's good news. I'll start with that.
Okay.
It's not good news for Mr. Trump. But I think it's, the sweep and scope of the case is pretty impressive. And there's a lot of speculation over the last couple of years about what they were doing down in Georgia. And I think, it was extremely well thought out, the way they placed it in the racketeering laws. I think having this enormity of state charges as opposed to federal charges is very good news for people in the camp of wanting to make sure Trump or a future Republican couldn't pardon him so easily. Mm-hmm. I think it's I think that, from what I've read of it, the extent of the charges, not only in the number, besides Trump, the a dozen and a half other people indicted, it's an impressive case that they've put together. And I think he's going to have a pretty hard time weaseling his way out of this.
Well, one of the arguments that has been made, and this is actually one made by some of the other of the guys on the show, Mike, for example, was that, this is the case that really should have come first. Yet this is going to be kind of the last out of the gate. Do you think that it's temporal positioning in terms of when it has happened plays an effect onto how it's going to be viewed or how it might play out legally?
I'm going to put that one over to Ken, who has more real world.
Okay, Ken, please take it away.
Yeah, I don't think it'll come last. I think the only one that could come before it is the January 6th case. But I think the New York case, although it was the first one where the indictment came down, Alan Bragg, the prosecutor in New York, has said repeatedly that he would slowball that case if in order to allow the federal cases to move ahead. And Judge Eileen Cannon in the Florida federal case seems really determined not only to slowball that case as much as possible, but to try to figure out ways she can slowball the other cases. So I don't think the Mar-a-Lago case or the New York case is going to move quickly. I think it's either going to be the January 6th case in D.C., or the Georgia case that comes first, and the other one of those two will come second. So I know, some people were thinking that the prosecutors should coordinate with each other to bring the big ones first. I don't actually think it would be proper for prosecutors to coordinate with each other that way. I think they all just had to bring the cases when they were ready to bring them. But I do think that it'll end up shaking out that way, that this one is not nearly the last.
Well, let me be careful about what I'm saying there, because I think you guys took me at face value, and that's fair. I think that was a mistake on my part. Okay. But let's be specific in the sense of, for example, Mike has on the show specifically, and Jay has on the show said specifically that these, I don't mean earlier in terms of when they're going to come to trial, but when, as you were there noting there at the end, Ken, that when the charges are brought, that some of these maybe either A, the charges just should not have been brought when you had maybe, quote unquote, more important cases like this in the wings, or should have waited for them to come first for the sake of being paid more attention to.
That's what I was getting more at. Where I was saying, I think that Mike and Jay's discussion of that was assuming that the prosecutors should take account of improper political considerations. And I just don't think prosecutors should do that. You know, the conduct in the New York case occurred first. The investigation of the New York case got done first. Probable cause to charge him was found first. So I don't think it would be proper for prosecutors to say, well, you know, I'm ready to bring a case, but there'd be more political impact if I let some other case come first. I think they just need to bring them in the order that, you know, as they're ready. And with the Georgia case, one thing that happened that I think led to it coming last was that when it became, you know, as it became really clear that the fake electors in Georgia were going to be charged, a bunch of them, I think, decided to cooperate. And so there was, you know, more information coming in towards the end. Like, I think Fannie Willis could have brought some charges, you know, 6 months ago. But then suddenly, like, some of the people she was going to charge would prefer to cooperate. So, of course, she needed to, you know, talk to them and collect all the evidence from them that she could. So, that, you know, that slows things down. But I don't think, you know, other prosecutors should be saying, well, there'd be more political impact if we let her go first, so we'll just wait. You know, I think they have to bring their cases when they can bring their cases.
I agree with you on that. But I also think, you know, I'm not sure the overall impact is that it's reduced. I mean, I think I'm not sure the order really matters to most people hearing the news. I think now it's just this cumulative effect of what he's got 91, if I'm correct, charges against him when you put everything together. And I think I'm just not sure that the order really has an impact. He has allegedly done all of these things that have led to these separate indictments. And I think just that they will, and you know, they may continue to pile on, but they'll pile on in the order that they come to the point they're ready to be brought. And I agree with Ken that prosecutors can't coordinate or delay that timing.
So in other words, the political assumption at the base of Mike and Jay's argument is effectively flawed, is what I'm hearing you kind of both agree on in this case.
Yeah, I would even go so far as to say unethical. Like, I think it would be unethical for a prosecutor to try to take account of political impact as a timing consideration for bringing a case.
So then the other piece here that I was looking at that I have thought about is, right, we have what I've already mentioned was Mark Meadows' attempt. He's one of the co-defendants in this, to move the case to federal court. And the argument being, at least from Meadows' team, is that this takes place under the auspices of his role as chief of staff and therefore should move to federal court. You know, a number of prominent lawyers have said, kind of talking about this, look, there's a chance that is going to be a possibility that this moves to federal court. So one question I'm going to have is, what do you think is that possibility? And then the second was kind of my editorializing on it, which was, even whether or not that happens, it seems like it is a likely way to create what I would suggest is the primary Trump legal strategy, which is to delay things, which means it's going to be another opportunity to have a motion which you can appeal and appeal before the primary charges can come to trial. So, Liz, again, I'll start with you. Kind of two questions there, right? Take them in any order you wish.
It's funny. I don't mean to be deflecting, but I think, again, Ken's got so much more experience in that on the litigation side than I do, having spent my career as a corporate lawyer. I'm not sure I know enough yet to know the likelihood of Mark Meadows being able to remove it to federal court. I'm thinking that's going to be a tough battle. But Ken, I'd welcome your thoughts on that one.
Yeah, I think he's got a chance. I think that his argument under the federal officer removal statute is not a frivolous argument. You know, I don't know that he's going to win it, but I think so many arguments I hear from the Trump people, I would just say, are frivolous. And here, I think what a federal judge is going to have to decide is what is the scope of duties of the chief of staff to the president, and if Meadows was doing things because he was the president's chief of staff and the president was having the chief of staff carry out the president's orders, and that was part of his job as chief of staff, then he's entitled to remove to federal court. On the other hand, if the trial judge finds that none of this stuff was within the president's duties, and therefore it wasn't within the chief of staff's duties to do the president's political work for the president, which was unrelated to the president's governmental job duties, then he won't be able to remove. But I think there's arguments, you know, these lines are blurry lines. The other thing that Trey asked, though, is whether this is going to cause a big delay. I definitely agree that Trump is trying to maximize delay. And I do think that, although I generally agree with Liz, that Fani Willis did a good job thinking about the legal theories, I'm not sure she fully thought through the litigation strategies. I heard her say in that midnight press conference that she was going to try all 19 of these guys together. That's just obviously not going to happen. And there's going to be some severance and some. I mean, she also is expecting, I think, that some of them will take guilty pleas and cooperate, and that they won't end up trying all 19 of them. But I think in the case of Meadows, you know, if he gets it severed, he gets it severed. And I'm not even sure she would appeal that if a federal judge says, I'm going to allow this case to be removed to federal court. Fani Willis would have a right to appeal that to the 11th Circuit. But I think she probably wouldn't. I think she probably wouldn't mind just moving forward with the rest of the case and trying him separately in federal court.
Liz, anything you'd like to add to that?
Yeah, and I think she'd be wise to let that go, too, because I think, you know, the big danger of having this big group of defendants, which I agree with Ken, at some point it will have to be split, is really the time factor, right? This is going to slow. It's going to be a slow process the more defendants you have. And so if the interest isn't getting, you know, Trump to trial more quickly, it doesn't really work against her interest to let Meadows slip away. And I'm sure she'll welcome as many, you know, defendants reaching deals as they can.
So now I recognize, of course, this is a legal matter, and that, you know, that's what we're going to focus on one front, and that's what you guys are both focusing on here. But it's, of course, also kind of a political matter, and so I can't help but be always curious about what's happening. How is this viewed? You know, where are people pulling on it? And so one of the things that I was a little surprised to see this week is when you take a look, at least this week, according to AP NORAC, that only about half of U.S. adults think that there's anything about the illegality of what was happening with Trump in terms of Georgia's vote count in 2020. Now, that might seem relatively high, but this is an area where when you start breaking it down, you get some weird differences here, right? So Democrats are not unanimous, but about as close to the unanimous as you're going to get in terms of polling at about 85%. You know, again, you're not as surprised to see that you only get about 16% of Republicans who are going to be saying the same. But it's independents, fascinatingly enough, where only approximately 40% of them, so far less than the overall average. So it's Democrats who are pulling that average. Only 40% of them are going to say that. And it's not that many more who even just say it's unethical. You know, again, this is an election year. We're talking about it, and it's in an election cycle, excuse me. We're talking about it in the terms of a primary right now. That's part of what we're going to talk about in a minute. What do you think the political outcomes of this trial are? I think one of the things that I see, and I'll just kind of start here, is that I think that for a long time, Democrats have been kind of waiting and hoping on the sidelines for these cases to come up. Because not just because they want to see justice done, but I think in part because they want to have kind of a political vindication and be able to say, well, look, you know, this is the way it's, you know, this is going to be kind of our chance to ride in. And I'm not sure that second half of it, right, justice aside, I don't think that second half is necessarily borne out in the data as I look at it. And I don't necessarily see, with the same kind of glee, again, an area where I know all three of us would agree is going to be, of course, I'm on the right, but I'm a never Trumper. But I don't necessarily agree. I'm curious where you're going to stand on this, Liz. I see a lot of Democrats kind of seeing this as having that second element, which is, and you see, not only is justice going to come, but this is going to win us points. This is evidence we're going to, we've got it. And I don't see that being the case. I'll start with you. What do you think about that, Liz?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I mean, it's It's complicated because, as you just said to yourself, you've got Republicans and you've got Never Trumpers, and there's different groups, right? And then you've got this MAGA base that'll support Trump no matter what, but not necessarily other Republicans. So it's like a complicated puzzle board. But I agree to some extent that Democrats may be somewhat overconfident, but I think that the Georgia trial changes things a little bit in the sense that, you know, you've got the people who will never, ever lose their faith in Trump. That base is just there. I think that the fact that these trials will be televised and so many more facts will be coming out, you know, there's also that whole question of how many Americans watch television anymore. But I think impact of the scope and sweep, and if it is televised and more facts come out, those will end up in TikToks and podcasts and people talking about it. I think this whole idea of stealing democracy hopefully would be offensive to more people. I think that there may be more Republicans and more independents that are disturbed, hopefully at the least, to hear how close things may have gotten and how many people were involved in such a grand way in trying to undermine the vote in Georgia. I think that, you know, it will really depend on what Trump does. I think, you know, if Trump continues to keep running, this is going to be a very tricky situation for the Republicans, because, you know, there is the base that won't leave Trump. But at some point, you know, if there's a possibility Trump's going to jail, they're going to have to.
Ken, what are your thoughts on this? Oh, so sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. I think Trump will be in jail soon, you know, long before these trials are done, because I don't think he's going to be able to maintain his conditions of release. And he hasn't really been doing it so far. And, you know, there's a bunch of judges. They're all trying to give him leeway. But if he keeps intimidating and threatening witnesses, intimidating and threatening the judges themselves, you know, that kind of thing, he'll probably be in jail, you know, by the end of February would be, or yeah, I'd say, well, no, we're in August. I'd say by the end of December, he'll be in jail, long before the trial. The other thing is, I think, you know, he can't win right now today. He's got no path to the presidency, and things are only going to get worse for him. So I think the kind of talk that Republicans are engaging in is if there's some possibility that Trump could be elected president of the United States in the 2024 election, you know, they're all living in a fantasy world.
Yeah. Well, Ken, let me ask you something. I agree with you that I think he should be in jail. And I think if he weren't Trump,
he'd already be in jail.
Yeah, he would already be in jail, clearly. And I think a lot of people agree that if he weren't Trump, based on his actions, he'd already be in jail. But to take Trey's tack of the political rather than the legal, you know, what do you think the impact is of him going to jail? For his base, it will completely energize. But will this persuade others to think it's political, even though it's clearly legal? I mean, I think I'm not sure what his going to jail does.
Well, it incapacitates him, right? So yeah. He's, I mean, let me compare this to what happened with the federal indictments or even the New York indictment. So when he's this is his fourth indictment already, but everyone so far, you know, you're talking about proceedings where there's no cameras in the courtroom, in some cases where he didn't even have to attend, where he was kind of able to characterize it as a kind of routine legal proceeding. And then what people actually see on TV is him like coming out of the courthouse and having a rally and giving a speech to his cheering followers and all that. You know, right now with the Georgia case, by the end of next week, you know, he's going to be brought into a jail where he's given a mugshot. That mugshot's going to be everywhere, you know, including that it's going to be in a jail. It's going to already start looking more serious, you know, to people right away, because of the optics of that. These charges are more serious and netted in more people, and more people are going to start turning against him publicly. You know, it may be that Jack Smith is already turning some witnesses as well, but that's all being done very invisibly. But when you've got, you know, 19 other people or 18 other people indicted, as in the Georgia case, then the process of turning and becoming cooperating witnesses is much more public and visible and transparent. And also he's, you know, he's going to actually force People like Governor Brian Kemp and Secretary of State Raffensperger, they've already kind of been forced by Trump's nonsense, you know, to be Republican voices who are calling him out. And I think in Georgia, that's what you're going to hear. So I think he only loses ground from where he is today. He has no chance of gaining any ground from where he is today. And from where he is today, he's in a position where he's, you know, could not possibly win a general election.
Well, it's funny. I think one of the things that listeners often say about our shows, Ken, is we don't disagree enough. And so I'm kind of glad that you made that possibility about Trump going to jail. I think this is one of the few times where I might have more vehemently disagreed with you. I think I think there's a zero chance that Trump is in jail by the end of the year. I don't see that as happening. I don't think that's going to happen. And I think it doesn't happen for entirely non-legal reasons. I don't think there are any. I don't think there is a judge, Democrat or Republican, who is going to place Trump into jail. Yeah, I'm not disagreeing with the legality of what you're suggesting, but I think you're just wrong that it's going to take an individual judge to do, and I don't think that's going to happen.
And yeah, I don't think he's leaving him much choice, though, Trey. He's threatening the judges themselves. He's threatening the witnesses. He's out there tweeting, you know, if anyone comes after me, I'm coming after them. You know, you can't run a trial if you have somebody out there doing that kind of stuff.
I don't disagree with that, but I still don't think that you end up having Trump in jail. I don't think there's a judge that wants to be the person who puts Trump in jail. And I think on the right, you're not going to have a Republican want to do it because they're not going to want to be ostracized from Republicans. And I honestly think the Democrats don't want to be the Democratic person to do it because then they're going to get labeled as doing it for political reasons. And that's actually why I'll go one step further. I understand the desire to want to say that that having the cameras makes Trump and having the mugshot makes it look worse. And just for listeners, keep in mind the reason this is the case is Georgia law actually requires that there be cameras allowed during judicial proceedings unless there is some compelling reason that a judge bar them. So they need to be able to have something like, say, well, look, we've got a juvenile victim or a witness. And those kinds of rules are unlikely to apply in this particular case. And again, I recognize that a lot of individuals are going to say, look, this is going to make Trump look worse. However, I'm going to go back to pre-2016, and that is precisely what I argued would happen to Trump when he started running for office. And I think it downplays one of the centerpieces of what makes Trump Trump, which is his ability to do well in the social media and the television space. And I honestly think this helps, does not hurt him. And I'm making that prediction because I was wrong so badly the first time when he was running. And I think it's easy to fall into that trap because when you follow him closely, you think, okay, this guy's just going to stumble. It's going to look terrible. He's going to look guilty. It's going to be horrible. And it doesn't end up working that way. He is either accidentally or purposely phenomenal at that.
Courtroom proceedings different. I'm sorry, Liz, you talk.
Yeah, no, I was going to say the same thing. I mean, I hear what you're saying, and he's a slippery eel, that one. But it is very different when he's in control of the situation. He's often been in TV when he's in control of the situation, and he's masterful at controlling his media presence and coverage. But I think, as Ken was about to say, I didn't mean to cut you off. It's different when you're a defendant in a legal proceeding. And just from reading the news coverage of the federal case and the other courtrooms he's been in, almost every piece of written journalism I've seen has said how he was, you know, a little bit cowed. Like, the judge came in and he was not his usual self. He was quiet. He was looking at his feet. Like, I think he won't be able to control the media spin when he's a defendant in a courtroom the way he has to date.
Right. And all the witnesses are going to be Republicans, too. So, you know, the witnesses are going to be the Georgia Secretary of State, the Georgia Lieutenant Governor, you know, people like that, the fake electors themselves, many of whom are going to turn against him. You know, so it's not going to look like this is a bunch of Democrats piling on. The most of what people are going to see when they watch these trials is Republican officials or Republican, you know, at least party officials, you know, saying that they were involved in these crimes with Trump. And he's only going to, you know, he's only going to get to, you know, be speaking, you know, maybe, you know, 5% at most of everything that anyone's going to hear. And he's immediately going to be shown to be a liar. Like everything that he says, they'll just put up evidence immediately showing that he's lying. And I don't think he's going to come out of this looking well. He doesn't get to control the pacing or anything like that of how information is presented.
Well, let's take this out a step further, because next week is scheduled to be the first Republican debate. And there has been a lot of hullabaloo as it comes around to the idea that everybody's going to have to support, sign a written support, that they're going to support the eventual nominee for the that wins the Republican primary. And Trump has made it relatively clear to this point that he's not going to do that, that, you know, he's not going to show up. And likewise, it appears that the RNC is going to potentially, you know, kind of hold their position here and say, you can't be in. This comes at the same time, I think, from the Trump side, at least, my reading of this is he's kind of playing his discussion about that alongside what's been going on in Georgia, because he argued on Truth Social this week, before he just 24 hours-ish later rescinded that he was going to have this big press conference instead. He was going to reveal all of his evidence. I was telling our Discord listeners, I said, listen, if he does it, it's going to be at the exact same time as the Republican debates. But he ends up pulling it, so I'm sort of kind of right. But what he then goes on to say is, look, it looks like he's going to have a competing interview with Tucker Carlson, maybe even on X, you know, the social media site formerly known as Twitter, in large part because of his anger at Fox News. Again, it's hard not to see what's happening in Georgia and him turning himself in, as it's all coming in the same week, next week, as the debate. Last thoughts about what goes down with the debate, and if your guys' hypothesis is correct and I'm wrong, you know, who is it? Right, nobody's polling right now in a way that seems like they can beat Trump. Does this even matter? Like, well, what's your take on that for next week as we kind of close out our thoughts on Trump with this conversation about the upcoming Republican debate? Liz, why don't you take us off first?
Yeah, so I'll go out on a limb here. My thought is that, you know, he turns himself in the day of the debate to take all the air out of the room, and that he gets all the coverage and the debate gets none.
That would be brilliant.
Yeah, he takes himself out of the debate at the exact time of the debate, so that other than maybe, you know, Fox News coverage of the debate, everybody else is covering Trump.
And that would then allow him to have the Carlson interview at a slightly later time, and therefore be talking about and spending that turn in. Okay. Ken, thoughts?
He better have that Carlson debate at a slightly earlier time, because unlike every other time he's been booked, he's not going to be out of there in 4 hours. I think he could well be in there 10 hours or 12 hours when he goes in to get booked this time. They've been really telegraphing that they're going to treat him like any other defendant who comes in to get booked. And it is not a 4 hour process or a 2 hour process like he's been getting. I basically think that why would he go to the debates? He's not going to go to the debates. He didn't even go to all the debates, you know, back in the in 16 or 20. And he is, you know, so far ahead of all the other Republicans right now. He really has nothing to gain by giving them a platform where, you know, they can be seen on the same stage as him. So I think for a million reasons, he's not going to these debates.
OK, well, I'll tell you what we're going to do. Why don't we pause here for just a brief moment, and we'll come back and we'll start up with our story on the Kansas City police raid on a paper. Okay, so Liz, Ken, the other bit, it was a small, might have been a small story, but it ended up being a really huge story, and it kind of gripped me, I'll be honest, was the small town of Marion, Kansas, ended up being maybe, and will continue to be, kind of a huge news moment. Late last Friday, police officers obtained a warrant for the local Marion newspaper, allowing them to search through 15 different types of materials, ranging from documents to electronics, on the suspicion of identity theft and unlawful acts concerning a computer. Now, the documents that were seized were all related to a Kerry Newell, and any of the devices had been used to access the Kansas Department of Revenue's website. Now, the judge who signed the order Laura Veer, has had her own kind of history, but we'll save that for just a minute. But she allowed the seizure to move forward, and that's unusual because you generally need a subpoena when you're dealing with the press. Now, this week, the Kansas Bureau of Investigation took the case over from those local police, and meanwhile, that search warrant that led to the Friday police raid was withdrawn, but not after kind of a worldwide focus on what was going on. Now, one possibility floated by the Marion County Record itself, that's the paper, was that it had had this as a result of an investigation into the local police chief who came from Kansas City proper under more than a little bit of suspicion. Now, another bit, again, as I was kind of mentioning there, is that the search warrant did not have a probable cause affidavit attached to it. Now, what that means is that generally a judge has to give a reason why they authorized the raid, and that has not been able to be produced. There isn't one. And this intersects with another important question, which is the Privacy Protection Act, which broadly prohibits law enforcement officials from searching or seizing information from reporters. But the police chief argued that the act did not, that this particular seizure did not fall under the act's category, and therefore that subpoena, that next level, wasn't necessary. And so this week, as a matter of fact, today on Friday, even the White House spoke out against this, saying this was kind of an attack on First Amendment rights. Ken, I'll let you lead off. What did you think about that? I mean, again, I was just kind of gripped by the whole deal because, again, having been involved in a lot of smaller times, smaller areas, smaller counties, this maybe resonated a little more for me. I don't know. I mean, I'm not always the big city guy like you are. Yeah. So.
Well, the facts are very dense and are very small townish, I guess. So there's kind of two different lines of narrative about, you know, what was going on. So so you have this new police chief in this town of Marion, Kansas. He'd been a longtime police veteran in Kansas City, I guess, and he came out to Marion to become the chief. And at least one thing that the newspaper is looking into is why did he leave Kansas City? Why did he come to Marion? And there's some rumors that he was, caught with doing sexual harassment of other police officers in Kansas City. No one knows if that's true or not, but it's or at least I don't know if that's true or not. But it seems that is one thing that the paper was looking into. And then there's this totally separate thing going on where there's a restaurant owner who's a kind of politically active in town, and she's both in the middle of getting divorced and she's trying to get a liquor license for her restaurant. And apparently her estranged spouse is going to the newspaper and saying, look, I'll give you all her DWI convictions, documents of all that. And so you can publish that she's not actually eligible to get a liquor license because she's been convicted of DWI too many times. And there's some question about how this guy got those records and whether these were confidential records that were somehow taken off of a police computer. Maybe somebody used identity fraud to get it off a police computer. So I think the sort of nominal basis for the search warrant was that they were looking into a crime of whether someone had gained access to these DWI records by hacking into a police computer or a court computer or by using a false identity to get onto those computers. And that might be a crime. And so that's nominally what they were searching for. But people also think that this is retaliation because they're looking into the police chief and his sexual harassment. So that's kind of my understanding of the very Peyton Place type, small town type facts, that these stories are intermingled with each other. In any event, I'm glad you focused on the Privacy Protection Act, Trey, because the First Amendment law in this area is not as good as it should be for the press. And the leading Supreme Court case, which is an old case from 1978 called Zurcher versus Stanford Daily, had actually held that police can go ahead and under the First Amendment and execute a search warrant based on probable cause in a newsroom and take confidential materials that a reporter has to work on a story. But Congress did overrule that case in the Privacy Protection Act of 1980, which is a statute that was passed specifically to strengthen press freedoms above what the court had held in Zurcher versus Stanford Daily. And I'm trying to get the key language of the statute here to read it. Yeah, so the Privacy Protection Act says, notwithstanding any other law, representatives of the government may not search a newsroom for the purposes of obtaining work product or documentary materials relating to a criminal investigation or criminal offense if there's reason to believe that the work product belongs to someone who will publish it in a public communication that affects interstate commerce. So the language is a little bit dense, but it definitely puts a strong presumption there that the police shouldn't take a reporter's information if the reporter's using that information still working on a story that they actually do hope to publish, and that's when the public will get the information. So it probably looks like there was a violation of that. And in fact, the DA already backed down and returned all the material that was taken.
Yeah, I mean that could have been because of the politics of it too. You know, that's an interesting question here. So, Liz, what anything you'd like to add here?
Yeah, I just add more on the human interest fund. I think Ken covered the law pretty well, but the judge, who you alluded to, some strange things. The judge also had a couple of DUIs, and there's been no clear connection, but some intimation that the judge and the restaurant owner also had some type of relationship. And also, I don't think I heard you mention in the beginning, but I thought one of the more human disturbing aspects of that raid was it was the owner, the editor, who I think is in his late 60s, and his mother, who was the owner, who was 98 years old, who died the day after the raid. That was kind of a big news story until the other stuff started to overshadow it. But it adds to the small town intrigue of what's going on in Marion.
Yeah, this was so upsetting for the 98-year-old owner of the paper that the police came and raided her newsroom. That stressed her out. And some people are saying that call. I mean, we don't have a coroner's report saying why she died, a 98-year-old
people. Well, and even if we did, I'm not sure if it was going to be like, and the cause was police raid. I don't think there's a box for that.
But it's disturbing nonetheless.
It definitely is.
And I think one of the things that's kind of that it's worth, I love that you kind of put in that human side there, Liz, is because, right, as a guy who does, you know, political communication is one of my areas, I think we forget how oftentimes, you know, what stories we kind of root to. And one of the things that makes a story far more sticky, something that we're going to think about and want to be connected to, is that personal element, right? You know, it's the old, right, if tens of thousands of people are hurt by a hurricane, that's sad in the passing. But, you know, watching the singular grandmother who's losing all of her possessions, that's the thing that we gravitate towards. Or in this case, right, the old woman who dies.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's also a little bit of mystery left still now about what the Kansas Bureau of Investigation is doing. And so the Kansas Bureau of Investigation is now investigating the case, but they've actually been pretty close-lipped about whether that means they're investigating the police and why they did this raid, or whether it means they're actually investigating the newspaper.
Right.
I mean, it could be either. We really don't know what they're up to right now.
The police chief, I believe, resigned. Was it yesterday? Yesterday or today?
It was late afternoon yesterday, I think, Liz.
Yeah. He stepped down, so I don't. Which may or may not mean that he's being investigated, but that it was my. I guess my suspicion was that they were investigating the raid more than the paper. But you're right; we don't actually know.
Yeah, and I never count on those kind of bureaus of investigation to you know be. Yeah, to investigate the people they ought to be investigating.
And see, this right here, I think, is why sometimes we get along so well, Ken, as well. To see, right, my libertarian distrust, I think, sometimes comes out in your more modern liberal distrust. And so we overlap. So I think we might want to move forward, come to another. And this is one, I think, in a different era where not as many things were getting kind of all of the news attention, would have probably been one of the lead stories for this week. But this past Monday, the United States Navy became the third military branch not to have a Senate-confirmed leader for the first time in history, at least according to Reuters and the Wall Street Journal. So Senator Tommy Tuberville of Alabama now has blocked numerous military nominations from moving forward, And he has argued that he will continue to hold the line on this front. Now, what he's doing precisely, again, for those who are trying to understand this, the Senate works through a process generally known as unanimous consent. And what that means is that all of the senators have to agree to the rules of debate on any particular bill or item that is coming forward to the floor. And if they all agree to it, then those rules hold. But any one particular senator who does not agree ends unanimous consent, and it doesn't stop that process from moving forward. But of course, it makes it a far more difficult process. And at this point, the Senate has not wanted to have to deal with that difficult process. Now, the reason that Tuberville has been taking this position is that he has argued that the Defense Department needs to change its policy to grant leave on reimbursement for travel costs for service members seeking abortions because there's no particularly good reason to do it. And secondly, in his phrase, Congress then needs to pass that policy into a law and to make that move forward. Now, the Senate could take up issues on either one of these fronts. It could continue to move these forward, but it just doesn't want to, in large part, because if you're not doing the normal process, it takes a lot of time. As of my last taking a look at it, the Congressional Research Service has been estimating that it would take several months for the Senate to get through all of the nominations that would be required. And Liz, I know this kind of intersects a little bit with your area, so I'm really curious what you think about what's been going on here in the Senate.
Well, I mean, I think it's ridiculous that one senator has held up so many hundreds of appointments and that the Army, Navy, and Marines all are lacking heads because of Tuberville. So I think it's pretty outrageous. But I also think he's taken an issue that is essentially a non-issue because he wants to throw abortion into the spotlight. I mean, I think the amount of spending, I don't have that exact figure with me now, but to cover abortions for service members as a percentage of our military budget is very, very small. I think it's also substantially less than it costs for pregnant military members to actually carry a pregnancy to term and have a child at all the costs involved in that and not be able to serve. So I think the funding argument is a really spurious argument that he's using because he is anti-abortion and he's using his power to block the appointments.
Ken, what do you think?
Yeah, well, of course, that's all correct. I mean, I think it's also, I mean, at the number and now the level of appointments that he's blocking, 300 people, including very high ranking people, there is definitely harm being done to U.S. national security. And, the Washington Post article that I think we all read, which lists all the vacant seats that are being held up now, the commander of the Pacific Air Force, the commander of the Air Combat Command in the U.S., the commander of the U.S. Northern Command in at the Space Force base in Colorado, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. If all these nominations are being held up, then it is definitely impairing military readiness. And, I don't know, what is going to be the thing that breaks the logjam. It seems to me the thing that should break it is just that Schumer should just move things forward on a simple majority vote. And maybe he will at some point. But that would be a tremendous break with tradition. But I don't really see Tuberville backing down. And I think there's a certain point where, that the majority in the Senate, has to think about changing its rules in order to function and in order to not grievously impair the U.S. national security.
I don't have as much sympathy for the Senate. I mean, this is part of the process. You have this. You know that you can do this. The Senate could put these through. I mean, there are the votes to make these happen. It's just a matter of they don't want to take the time to do it. These could be going through. Would it take a while? Of course. Like I was just mentioning, it would take several months to get now because of the backlog you now have.
Where they can't do anything else, where they can't legislate.
I mean, that's true. But I mean, that's the rules that you operate under. And they should have been doing this at the outset, right? When Tuberville stuck in and said, look, I'm not gonna have unanimous consent. They should have not allowed this giant backlog. They should have been going through through what you call the long vote process in the Senate at the outset. In all honesty, my guess is I don't think you're going to see Schumer make that kind of move. Not because it wouldn't necessarily be a possibility, but because I think he likes it, right? This is phenomenal if you're a Democrat in terms of like running for election. You don't want to change this process. And you could, and again, you've got the Republican votes to make it happen had you been doing it all the way through. But it's a great political issue. And Tuberville thinks he's winning. Democratic leadership think they're winning. And as a result, no one's going to vote on these.
Well, you know, I think you might be right that Schumer isn't going to make the change I'm advocating, but I would think there'd be a different reason for that. I don't think the Democrats are winning. I actually think Tuberville, you know, is single-handedly, you know, defeating the Biden administration and the Senate majority. And it's not only is it not a good for the country, it's not a good look for the Democrats. But I think the only reason that Schumer might tolerate it is because he's actually more worried that the Dems could lose the majority. Right. So he doesn't want to change rules that protect minorities, you know, right before they maybe become the minority. And so I think that might be what's keeping him. But it's hard for me to see that this is a good issue for the Dems. I mean, it's a real erosion of national security that's taking place because one Republican senator is able to push around the rest of the government.
Yeah, I agree with you on that, Ken. And Trey, I was going to take issue with you thinking this is good for the Dems, because I think, you know, that's one historical issue is the Republicans pressing Dems as being weak on security. And I think having this number of positions open and the country at risk, it makes an argument that under Biden's watch, you know, our national security has eroded. And even with the Dems controlling the Senate, they haven't been able to protect us. So I agree. I don't think this is great for the Dems. I don't think it's great for the country. It's bad news what's going on in Congress right now.
But again, I mean, you could go through the non-fast track process, and you could have done that, 285.
No, it's not. That's not a realistic answer. I mean, like, for instance, the government needs pretty soon a budget, or, you know, there's going to be a government shutdown. Now, you know, they have to work on that. It's not actually possible to work on both, right? So it's either, you know, they're gonna confirm a few military commanders while the whole rest of the government shuts down, or they're gonna, you know, work on trying to keep the government open and get some kind of continuing resolution. In which case, there is no time to confirm these nominees.
I think that's one. I mean, again, maybe I recognize this is a place maybe where we're going to disagree a little bit. But that's to say, oftentimes the argument is Congress needs to be able to move more rapidly. And I hear that, right? There's lots of things that Congress has to do. There's lots of things that the Senate has to do. But simultaneously, the purpose of a deliberative body is to have deliberation. And if the fundamental argument is, well, look, our processes are such that if we can't fast track everything, then we can't actually function. That's a broader problem with your deliberative democracy than the particular vote.
It's not, Trey. It's just a problem with the size of our U.S. military. The number of military promotions is not, you know, if the U.S. Congress, you know, spent 100% of its time only working on military promotions and never working on anything else, it still wouldn't have enough time to do all the military promotions.
True.
Right. So you can't run it that way. You have to run it. They have these unanimous consent rules so they can function. And people have sometimes used these holds to make a point.
They have unanimous consent.
They never hang on to it this long, and they never do it in ways that cause serious harm to the national security. This is unprecedented.
We have unanimous consent rules in the Senate because we want to have the possibility of holding things up. It is there. The reason that it continues to exist is because both sides at different points wants to be
sides.
Able to throw
no.
wrenches
no one,
into
no one has ever, no one has ever
the process.
Done anything like this. Trey, no one has ever done anything like this before. It's not a both sides thing.
Well, who was the first person to go nuclear? It was Republicans on Democrats who wouldn't put forward judges.
Right, but that's different. I mean, the judges, you know, it's conventional to have a hearing on a judge. It's not conventional to have a hearing on every single routine military promotion. These are promotions that are, you know, recommended internally within the military. These aren't political appointments. There's not supposed to be hearings on these, and there couldn't be in the nature of things. I mean, it's not a fair comparison because every single federal judge does get a confirmation hearing.
Now, be clear, I wasn't trying to make a comparison between that. What I'm trying to say, though, is that the purpose of unanimous consent was not to try to get things done, but to try to not get things done.
No, I mean, every military promotion in the history of the country until now came through this unanimous consent process.
It had to, because that's what existed. But I'm saying the reason we continue to deal with unanimous consent in the Senate is because we universally want there to be holdups in the senatorial process.
Right, but there's rules and there's norms. Like, it would be normal for there to be holdups, but the holdups are, you know, until people start paying attention. And then the person, you know, the Tuberville could make his point about the, you know, the abortion funding. You know, he's made his point. The media's heard his point. The public's heard his point. You know, and in history, at that point, they'd let the hold drop. They wouldn't just keep going to the point where we don't even have a Pacific force. If China invades Taiwan tomorrow, you know, we don't have a chain of command in the Pacific to deal with that because of Tuberville. Nobody's ever done anything like that before.
Liz, you want to take on too? Get me.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm on Team Ken on this one. No one's ever done this. And to add to what Ken just said, you know, the rest of the world knows this as well because of all the media attention. So any enemies we have out there, people know that in the Pacific we have no head of the chain of command. Like the absences are glaring and public and put our country in jeopardy. And so I think that it's a bridge, it's a step too far when Tuberville is doing this political gamesmanship with national security. I just don't think there's any excuse for it.
Well, I'll take the outside on this one, but I will say it's been a lot of fun to get beat up on from both of you. I mean that honestly, though. It's a lot of fun having you on the show, Liz. Well, Ken, Liz, thank you guys so much for both joining me. And Liz, again, I want to double thank you for putting up with me and Ken. I mean, you know, having to listen to our craziness on the show. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, though. I got to tell you, I'm slightly disappointed we didn't cover McGonagall, only because I was going to tell you both that I have a funny personal connection to this story, because I don't know if Ken ever mentioned to you, but my husband and I lived in Russia for a couple of years, and Potanin was our neighbor in Russia. So when this story broke about McGonagall and this corruption scheme, I was floored to see first that he basically sacrificed his career and reputation in life for a payment of $17,500 from a guy who's a billionaire, but he was being paid by Deripaska to reveal information on Potanin, who's probably one of the only, you know, if there's such a thing as a good oligarch, one of the only good oligarchs left. And the media has not put much attention on the fact that Deripaska is basically a puppet of Putin, and Potanin is one of the only viable opponents, you know, left of Putin, that's still not jailed or poisoned.
See, I should have known that, given my long history with Ken, that you would be all over an espionage and diplomacy story. I love it.
I actually know. I know some of the people involved in this story on the New York side of it too. So yeah, that's.
Well, I'd tell you what we'll have to do. I think this is going to be one we could go into again. I think next time we're all together, we should go into this in detail. Maybe even kind of lead with it. I think that'd be a lot of fun all the way around and do that, because I think that would be a lot of fun anyway. I had some things for it, but I will stop us there because I know for our show, we're kind of coming to the end of the time. Yeah. What I wanted to do say as I kind of end us up is if you've come to this far with us on the Politics Guys, and you're not already a supporter of the Politics Guys, I really hope you'd consider becoming one, right? What makes this show possible is some really amazing supporters. That's what makes the podcast possible. That what makes it possible for myself and for Ken and for Mike and for Jay to do what we do. And we're not just asking you to do it out of the goodness of your heart. We're asking you to do it because you get all kinds of really cool, good stuff. Like, for example, the ad-free version of everything that we put out, including this show right now. It also gets you an exclusive show, our supporters' exclusive midweek show, where, at least in the case of Ken and myself, we break away from the constraints of the news cycle and discuss the Constitution. We've been going through the U.S. Constitution. This week, we were just going through the Article 5 of the Constitution, the amendment process. And I'd love for you to be able to join that part of the show and have those midweek cycles with myself and Ken. And hey, maybe at one point, Liz, if you'd ever consider joining us, diving into the Constitution or one of the amendments. So there's all kinds of cool things you get as a supporter. One of the other ones that I'll mention in addition to the supporters' exclusive midweek show is our very active Politics Guys Discord group. As a matter of fact, between doing some of the recordings, I was actually doing some videos of what I was recording with Ken and posting it on there, and supporters were taking a look at that. That's always a lot of fun. I love interacting on that space, and I'd love to interact with you as well. So if you would be interested in any of those, what you can do is you can go to patreon.com/politicsguys. That's again, patreon.com/politicsguys. And you can see all the different levels of support, the different things you get at those different levels of support. And you can select your level of support and start joining in and getting all of those really cool benefits. If you'd like to support us in other ways, there's other possibilities as well. On Venmo, we're at politicsguys. You can also support the show through PayPal. All of those support links and others are available in the show notes. And if you like typing it into a browser, you can always head to politicsguys.com/support for the whole menu of options. Now, if you'd like to get the midweek show, but you're just not in a position to do that financially right now, listen, I get that. I've got 3 kiddos and I work in education. So yeah, I know what that's like. All you got to do is just reach out to us at mail@politicsguys.com and we can get you set up. And that's a lot of fun too. So please, if that's the case, just again, send something to mail@politicsguys.com and we'll get you set up. Now, whether you're a supporter or not, I know that I would really appreciate it if you would subscribe, rate, and review us on whatever podcast app you use. So click down there on Spotify, on Apple Music, or anything in between, and just share out that episode. That is huge for us. If you've got a question, a comment, a correction, a gripe, a manifesto, or just anything else you'd like to share, you can always reach us at mail@politicsguys.com. We're also on Facebook and X, and you can find all of those links in the show notes. I want to give a special shout out, as always, to the executive producers of the Politics Guys. Thank you all. To Bruce Johnson, Wilma Marino, Andra Masker, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, and Don Oglesby. We'll be back with a new episode this next week. I hope you'll join us then.